Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is writer and historian Scott Ellsworth, who wrote the first comprehensive history of the Tulsa Race Massacre, his 1982 book, which raised a veil on Tulsa's history, Death in a Promised Land. Ellsworth has made the work of uncovering the truth about this episode of racial violence his life's work. He has served as chief historian on the Race Riot Commission ahead of the 75th anniversary and is now chairing the Physical Investigation Committee, which is working to identify the unmarked grave sites of race massacre victims for the Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission. His latest book, The Groundbreaking, tells the story of his work to identify an accurate estimate of how many died on May 31st and June 1st, 1921, as well as the long story of his work to understand fully the comprehensive history of Tulsa in May and June of 1921. Dr. Scott Ellsworth is a lecturer at the University of Michigan's Department of Afro-American and African Studies and is a former historian at the Smithsonian Institution. His other books include the New York Times bestseller, The Secret Game, which won the 2016 Penn ESPN Award for Literary Sports Writing. The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice, is published by Dutton. And Scott Ellsworth is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Scott Ellsworth, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
The Groundbreaking is the story of Tulsa's long struggle to come to terms and openly acknowledge the events of May 31st and June 1st, 1921. It's also a bit of a memoir of your work to learn the full truth of the race massacre. What are the questions that are still out there for you today?
Oh, gosh, there's quite a few. I mean, there's, you know, we know a lot about the massacre now, how it happened and things like that. But I certainly two issues that I think are of huge importance, or maybe three. The first would be we still to this day don't have an accurate estimate of the number of people who died in the massacre. I think that reasonable estimates, reasonable ones, go from somewhere in the 70s to perhaps as high as 300. But we don't know if that number is 79 or 299. We also don't know what the ratio is between black and white casualties. You know, in the popular mind today, there were just even the notion of calling it a massacre, you know, implies that it's going to be heavily tilted in one direction. But there were survivors I spoke with in the 70s who said, you know, we got as many of them as they got of us. I think the other question, you know, it's kind of tied together, that's a big hole, is after the violence began at the courthouse, and prior to the invasion of Greenwood at dawn on June 1st, there were a group of white men who went out organizing other whites to take part in this dawn invasion. We don't know who those people are. We know that they, you know, met at like 3rd and Lewis and at 15th and Boulder and stand up on their cars and tell people what to do, but we don't know who they are. And probably tied to that is the notion is we don't know exactly when the Ku Klux Klan came back to Tulsa. There's some pretty strong evidence to indicate that they didn't organize in Tulsa until after the massacre. And we know they were huge, you know, after the massacre, but we don't know if they were there beforehand. So those would be two areas that are really quite big in my mind.
As I mentioned, The Groundbreaking is much a personal story as well. And of course, you've been intimately involved in the retelling of this event and intimately involved in resolving some of these questions that we're still waiting to be definitively answered. Was the only way to tell the story of The Groundbreaking was to make it a memoir, first-person account?
Well, that's really funny you bring that up, because that was a big struggle that I had, and also one that you know, my editor and agent, we talked about, because I really did not want to make it a memoir. I mean, I tell about an incident that happened when I was 12, and there's a couple things, but you don't really learn that much about me, I think. And the problem is that I've been doing this for so long, you know, off and on for 45 years, that I was involved in a lot of these sort of key moments. So I had to show up, you know, that was the only way to tell the story. But I talk a little bit about myself, but I really tried to keep myself in the background, I guess not as effectively as I'd hope that I had.
Well, I ask that because, you know, a historian is all about being dispassionate and putting themselves outside of it. But really, in an event like this, there's no way you can't. I mean, you've been a part of what was the Race Riot Commission on the 75th anniversary. You've been intimately involved in the search for mass graves in the last few years. There's just no way to tell it without putting yourself into the story.
No, I think that's probably true. And so I just tried to do it, as quietly as possible.
Well, one of the things that's really interesting that you do share is your own story of how you came to learn about what was then the, quote, race riot, and how you first began to learn the real story. Because when you first began investigating it, what was known about it was incredibly shadowy. And there were also a lot of misinformation about what actually happened on May 31st and June 1st, weren't there?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, you know, I'm born and raised in Tulsa. And, you know, even as a kid in the 60s, you know, as a 10 or 11-year-old, you would occasionally hear older adults talking about the mass of the race riot, what we call them those days. And whenever you go into the room, they would change the subject or lower their voices. And I had heard some of these kind of urban legends, you know, about bodies floating down the Arkansas River or machine guns on top of buildings downtown, but there was no way you could really find out anything about it until the summer of that I was 12 years old. And I had a couple of buddies, running buddies, and we didn't have, you know, we mowed lawns and stuff, but we didn't have full-time jobs. So summer, it was off, and we would just go wander all day long, and oftentimes downtown, and we would get into all sorts of minor troubles, sneaking into construction sites and stuff. We'd always end up at the beautiful downtown, brand new city county library. And one day we walked in there and we saw something we had never, ever seen before, which was a microfilm machine. And we were just automatically determined to use it. So we go over there and start fiddling with the dials. And this librarian comes marching over, and she was brilliant because rather than shoo us away, she instead sat down with us and explained how we use the machine. And there were cabinets nearby, these big metal cabinets that had rolls of microfilm of old issues of the Tulsa World and the Tulsa Tribune. And somehow, by that time, I knew that this race riot had happened in June of 1921. So the first reel we fed into the machine was for the June 1921, issues of the Tulsa World. And we were just gobsmacked by what we saw, you know, these giant headlines, 100 killed, city under martial law. And we weren't sophisticated enough to know what it meant. But at age 12, I knew that there was a skeleton in my hometown's closet and that the real story wasn't being told yet.
Throughout the book, you describe how you began to suss this out. The story that was in print at that time didn't say this all kicked off because of a confrontation over trying to avoid a lynching of a black man. It was a completely different story that was out there. And you credit W.D. Williams, as you began sussing this story out and trying to understand it and running into lots of dead ends, W.D. Williams was the first person that really gave you a good sense of what you were looking at on those days.
Oh, he was absolutely the key. So during the summer of 1975, I'm a 21-year-old college student. I've come back to Tulsa, and because I decided I wanted to write my senior thesis about the race riot. And I just had a devil of a time finding anything. You know, you couldn't find any photographs or hardly any. All these records were missing. There were these sort of sugar-coated accounts in kind of various books that would say something like, well, there was an incident in the elevator. Some hotheads got mad. Some shots were fired. Some stuff was wrecked. And then the good white citizens of Tulsa rebuilt Greenwood. And that was that. And I had run across, though, a photograph of Greenwood after the riot, and I was just amazed by it. It just looked like, you know, Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And so one day, you know, near the end of that summer, I ran into this woman named Ruth Avery. And Ruth was a native Tulsan. She was about 7 at the time of the massacre, and a flatbed truck upon which had been loaded the bodies of African-American massacre victims drove right in front of her house, and that had made this huge impression on her. And so she decided, as a, you know, untrained writer and historian, a Tulsa housewife, that she was going to write a book about this. And she was a friend of a friend of my mom's best friend. And I ran into her one day, and she was always very encouraging. And she said, "How's it going?" I said, "Ruth, I can't figure out how we go from this seemingly nothing incident in an elevator into this, you know, racial Holocaust." And she said, "Well, have you ever talked to W.D. Williams?" I said, "No, who's that?" And she explained that he was a retired a teacher from Booker T. Washington, that his family had been very prominent in Greenwood before the massacre, and that he knew a lot about it. And I called him up, and I ended up interviewing him. And I thought it was just going to be an hour-long interview, and it lasted for like 3 hours or something. And that was the day everything changed, because he was in the right place at the right time and saw everything that happened. And it was because of him and then other elderly African-American massacre survivors that he ended up introducing me to, that I interviewed in 1978, that was really, you know, in my opinion, why we were able to save the story. And because these people really, with the exception of Mr. Williams, they hadn't been interviewed by anyone. And this is the first time they were ever on tape. And capturing that material really helped us to understand what really happened.
My guest today is Scott Ellsworth, a historian, a lecturer at the University of Michigan in the Department of Afro-American and African Studies. Of course, he's the author of the first major history of the Tulsa Race Massacre, Death in the Promised Land. And his latest book is titled The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice. It's published by Dutton. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, at the beginning of the book, you tell the story. This is a story I've read twice within the last week. A story of a Tulsa police sergeant showing a box of photographs. These photographs just appeared in the early 1970s, and they show some of the most grisliest images of the race massacre and possible mass grave sites. He shows them to them. A couple of officers ask questions. He gathers them up, and then that box of photographs, as far as we know, has disappeared to history. What is important about that story? Because this is a theme that shows up in the book, of trying to nail down what was actually seen in those photographs.
Yeah, so that was a story. We learned about the officer, his name is Robert Patty, who was the young officer that the sergeant showed him the photos at Tulsa Police Headquarters, you know, in 73 or 74. And he had told us this story in Dick Warner of the Tulsa Historical Society, who worked with me on starting the search for the grave back in 2002. But our first effort to find the graves had already been shut down, and there was nothing we could do about it. And then 2 years ago, in 2019, when newly elected Mayor Bynum asked me to help restart the investigation, Dick's daughter, Betsy Warner, reminded me of that letter. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's right. And, you know, the account, Dick interviewed Mr. Patty back in 2002, and there was just a lot of detail about the story. The story just seemed really good. And then we ended up tracked down Bob Patty, and I interviewed him in 2019. And he told essentially the same story that he had told Dick, you know, 20 years earlier. So there's just a sense of detail to it that sounds good to me. It also linked up with a lot of stories. This is the area where we believe this mass grave is located, is in the New Block Park / the Canes area. The Canes is a homeless encampment right about where the 11th Street Railroad Bridge is, right next to New Block Park. And we have a lot of evidence over the years of people talking about bodies being taken there. You know, but the problem, Rich, as you know, you could take a 10-foot by 10-foot square hole, and you could bury 100 bodies in it. And unless you have a specific piece of ground to look at, it's very difficult to find these graves. But, you know, we're not giving up, and we're still at it.
Yeah. You know, this gets into another story, which is how so much of the, quote, official story of the massacre has been up to now suppressed. You write about, you know, you go to government buildings, and much of the material was just missing. You see pages torn out of newspaper archives and microfiche that way. Official records are missing. Do you expect any of these things to turn up, like that box of photographs, or do you think that has just been definitively destroyed?
Oh, hope springs eternal. I certainly hope that things will come out. But the reality is this, Rich, is that, it's been painful for a lot of Tulsans to talk about this. And there's plenty, particularly in the white community, who don't want it mentioned at all and whatnot. But I think the city is coming to terms with its past. But as that has happened, we're starting to see more and more materials come out. There have been some photographs, incredible photographs of the massacre that are now at the Department of Special Collections at the McFarland Library there at the University of Tulsa that, nobody had seen before, and they've just popped up in the last couple of years. So I'm hopeful that more material will come forward.
Let's talk about those two big questions you say that are out there. First, an accurate estimate of how many dead. I'm really struck by what the head of the Red Cross relief effort, Maurice Willows, stated. He had done a survey, and he said, roughly about 300 people were being reported as missing, and that's family members looking for men and women. And, that really strikes me as that 300, that gives a lot of credence to that 300 figure. What is your own personal assessment of the official estimate of what it should be?
Well, again, I think reasonable estimates go from somewhere in the 70s to about 300. I'm convinced that there are over 100 people killed. But, I think it's, these are important questions, and it's important to try to get as close as we can to truth. I'm open for it to be other numbers. There's been a tendency lately to always use the highest estimate and to act as if that's actually kind of a basement estimate. We just don't know. I mean, it's 300 people are a lot of people. And those 300 people had loved ones elsewhere and things like that. So we're just really beginning this work now. We know, for example, of 18 identified and unidentified massacre victims that were buried by white funeral homes in Oak Lawn Cemetery in Tulsa. Until last October, we didn't think we knew exactly where they were, but now we think we do. Even tracing their descendants is a lot of work to be done. But I think there's a lot of work that people could do with city directories and other materials in terms of counting up all the people who show up in the Tulsa City Directory in Greenwood, in 1921 and see who's still there in 1922 and 1923. I think there's some ways we can get at this. But we may never know definitively, but hopefully we'll have a better estimate.
Of course, a big part of the groundbreaking is about that work to identify mass graves. There have been major archaeological digs in Oak Lawn Cemetery, and there has been the discovery of remains at this point. Those are still being re-evaluated to understand who and when those souls died. What is your best guess on when we'll actually know definitive information from that discovery in October?
Right. So this is my committee, the Physical Investigation Committee, and I work with a wonderful team of archaeologists and forensic scientists, people from the State Medical Examiner's Office, and just really top-notch experts, not just from Oklahoma, but elsewhere in the country. And we are going to begin an exhumation of that mass grave on June 1st. It'll take several weeks. The human remains are in extremely fragile condition, but it's our hope that we will be able to possibly extract DNA from some of the remains, if not all of the remains, that we'll be able to, these forensic scientists, they can identify things like racial characteristics and gender and age. Hopefully we'll be able to determine cause of death. So there's a lot of work that will be happening this summer. And then the plan is to ultimately, these people were all buried, by the white authorities while African Americans were all being held under armed guard in these internment camps. So Greenwood citizens didn't find out what happened to their brother or their father or their son. Nobody told them where their loved ones were buried. And so this is going to be a chance for the city to bring these people back home. They're all murder victims, every one of them, and they need to be buried with honor, and they need to be memorialized with honor. It's my hope that we have an appropriate memorial. It may be something like the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington National Cemetery, but I think it'll become a national shrine in a way. But there's a lot of work still to be done.
And, of course, that's not the only site that your committee is looking at, not only at Oaklawn, but also Rolling Oaks, way out in South Tulsa. That has had people suggest that there may be a mass grave there, and also the area around New Blocks and the Canes. Do you expect that your committee will actually get around to being able to do some sort of digs or information so we have some definitive answers about those particular sites?
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, the city has been very supportive of this effort. They funded everything adequately. You know, I think we'll just have to take steps, you know, one at a time. The situation at New Block and the Canes is finding more definitive answers as to where this trench grave, you know, may be located. So there's a lot of preliminary work before any sort of digging is going to be done. But, you know, hopefully this is something that, you know, as Tulsans, look, this has been hard for some Tulsans to deal with this past, but we need to make amends here. And, you know, I think this is going to be, you know, years in the making.
Speaking of making amends, once again, there are people in the city talking about reparations. Tulsa Metropolitan Ministry is actively raising funds to do something, a symbolic reparation. You know, you were very much involved in that in the 75th Anniversary Commission. Do you expect reparations to ever be paid to either the survivors or families of the survivors?
Well, look, I think, you know, just to be, you know, completely upfront, I mean, first of all, reparations is a very complicated issue in general. And anyone who says it isn't is kidding themselves. Obviously, there's a huge divide about reparations, largely, though not exclusively, along racial lines. That being said, and look, there's no doubt in my mind that the descendants and the three survivors we still have with us deserve some form of monetary restitution. You know, the Tulsa Race Massacre was a definable event. It lasted for only so long. It won't be that hard to figure out who these people are. They were let down by their city. They were let down by their state. They were let down by the federal government and also by insurance companies. You know, people owned insurance policies on their homes and personal belongings, their businesses, and none of the insurance companies paid. I think, you know, realistically, in our current divided political climate, the best chance for reparations will come from the federal government. But I also hope that these insurance companies will see that they have an opportunity here to make good on claims that they wrongfully denied, you know, nearly 100 years ago. So I think it's going to be an uphill battle, but I think it's an important one.
My guest today is Scott Ellsworth, a historian. His latest book is titled The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice. In many ways, it's a follow-up to his book, Death in the Promised Land. And it's a new book coming out from Dutton, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. There's a lot of fears in the African-American community that after this centennial, the commemoration will take place, that nothing will change down the road for the huge disparities in our community that are a sort of an underlying issue of this racial divide and the racial reckoning. What do you think needs to come out of this commemoration moving forward to make this? I know you've talked about the National Park Service as being a way to commemorate what happened in Greenwood. What do you think needs to happen down the road?
Well, I do think the National Park Service would be great if they'd come in. But I think we also just have to have, we need to have an understanding of our past, what it is. Look, there are many, many things that are wonderful about, you know, first of all, we don't have to be afraid of our history, okay? Our history is what it is. And we should certainly celebrate America's many and great and fundamental gifts to the world. There are many things in our past that we should teach our students. but we also don't need to sugarcoat it, and we don't need to avoid difficult topics. You know, Oklahoma school children aren't a bunch of snowflakes or robots. You know, they need to learn about the Tulsa Race Massacre and the Trail of Tears and 9/11 and Pearl Harbor and everything. You know, it's a part of it. So that's going to be a part of it. I think the other thing is that we have to have an understanding that, you know, as one of my favorite authors, William Faulkner, once said, the past isn't dead. It's not even past. You know, the Tulsa Race Massacre still casts a horrible shadow upon our city. It's kept it divided, you know, in terrible ways that we need to get over and get beyond. And I think, you know, having a better realization of what the economic consequences of the massacre were for African Americans that extend to this day, I think that's vital in a way of moving ahead. And while, you know, paying restitution, even a token amount of restitution, may seem like a lot of money in the long run, I don't think it will be.
Talk a little bit about the economic destruction in our last couple of minutes here. I think there is not a sense of how much destruction, economic destruction, took place. We know the physical destruction. We can see the pictures of that. But what about the economic destruction?
Well, you know, I think there's just, you know, the work on this is still just coming along. But, you know, there's a figure coming out in National Geographic on their June 1st issue that claims that had the massacre not occurred in Greenwood today, the generational wealth that would be there today is equivalent to $600 million. That's an astonishing figure. I mean, that's decades of college tuition, down payments on houses, down payments on transportation, that seed money for new businesses and things like that, that was all wiped away, never to be found again. And I just think that we need to have an honest look at ourselves on the impact of things like the massacre, Jim Crow laws, all of that, on preventing progress, economic growth from happening in parts of, you know, the American populace. So I think that, you know, we need to not just dismiss that. You know, that's a lingering shadow that's still with us today.
The name of the book is The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice. Scott Ellsworth, it's a great pleasure to have you with us on Studio Tulsa.
It's wonderful to be back on KWGS. Thanks so much for having me.
Historian and writer Scott Ellsworth speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the author of the first major history of the Tulsa Race Massacre, the 1982 book Death in a Promised Land. His latest book is titled The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice. It's published by Dutton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thank you very much for listening.